Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Allen. And coming up here, there is a series of presentations that are called Climate Science Cafes, and it's being put on by some folks from Michigan Tech, and I have a couple of people here. Sarah Green is professor of chemistry at Michigan Tech. Robert Handler is part of the Michigan Tech Sustainable Futures Institute. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, let's go ahead and talk a little bit about the presentation themselves. What was the idea behind this?
So a science cafe is meant to be a really informal place where people can go and get informed and ask questions and interact with other people who might have concerns or questions similar to theirs and learn from each other and from people who are experts on the topic.
This topic is climate change. Have you done other science cafes with other topics before?
No. This is the first for me and the first on climate change that I know of in the area.
I was part of a science cafe in the Marquette area last spring where we talked about natural gas fracking and the new technologies surrounding natural gas extraction and the environmental and social implications of those new technologies happening and changing so rapidly. So that was somewhat related to climate change, but people had many other questions about that technology as well. And that was a really great opportunity in the Marquette area.
So what was the motivation for doing one on climate change?
Well, we had been starting discussions as a group of community members, folks that are employed by Michigan Tech, other folks in the community that just have an interest in this topic. And we were talking to an organization in the Marquette area that wanted to start a climate advocacy group, and we wanted to do something similar here, but maybe with a focus more on engaging the community and responding to people's questions and concerns as opposed to more direct government advocacy as a way to start the conversation. So that's the approach that our community here decided to take. So that's why we've started this series of conversations.
Well, I'm very interested to, you know, hear about things that you're going to be sharing during these cafes, because I was a member of the media for a number of years. You learn the art of walking the fence, you know, of being, not falling on one side of an issue or the other, but trying to remain as impartial as you can. Well, climate change is a little difficult to do. And so, you become, like I said, kind of a climate change agnostic is, understanding the a little bit of the argument that explains climate change, but then you're also aware of all the voices on the other side that argue against it or present opposing views. I've had the privilege of talking to a lot of very educated people who are in the know. And what I mean in the know, they're people like yourselves, people that study these types of issues rather than just talk about them. One of the people I talked to at Michigan Tech was the wolf guy, John Vucinich, one time. Mm-hmm. And in casual conversation, he gave me an analogy that I had never heard before, but was enough to start tipping me off that fence a little bit, and it was about trees. And we must have been talking about wolves and moose, because I don't think he studies much else, wolves and moose. But when we were talking about trees, he said about tree migration, that trees that were not in this area or very rare, but were common, even below the Michigan border, have begun to appear in mid and northern Michigan and now in the Upper Peninsula. And trees that were common in the Upper Peninsula are now basically moving north. And for a layman, for a guy that doesn't spend my life surrounded by science all the time, that was an analogy I could picture in my mind of evidence of a change in climate is, okay, if the trees are smart enough to know to head north to find cooler weather, then maybe they know something. So am I the kind of person that would benefit from these kinds of presentations?
Ooh, I certainly hope so, and I hope some of your listeners would as well. Can I get back for a minute to the issue of media balance?
Sure.
And I actually have studied this issue from the science standpoint, because it's a very, as you know, politicized issue right now, where you have this idea that there's some kind of balance in the media and confusion. But among scientists, there is no confusion. And we did a study of the scientific literature. We actually looked at 12,000 papers on that mentioned climate change as a keyword. And 97% of them that took a stand on the issue agreed that the climate is changing and that humans are the cause. And other studies have put that number among scientists between 90 and 100%. And so there's really no more debate in science about whether this issue is important and is happening and is caused by humans. It's the media that is, and other voices that are trying to confuse the issue.
How do we know climate change is happening?
There's lots and lots of evidence. So there's temperature records from that are pretty good since the 1850s, late 1800s. But we also look at tree rings and ice cores all the way back to 800,000 years ago. So we can tell that there's something definitely different in the climate now in terms of global temperatures. We can track the concentrations of greenhouse gases, that is especially CO2, carbon dioxide, in the atmosphere. And we've been doing that very carefully since the 1950s. And we can see that that's going up. We understand the basic physics that how greenhouse gases work, that is why the planet isn't freezing. So that's been known since the late 1800s. Many, many lines of evidence, and including the biological ones like you mentioned, migration of trees, the growing season here for gardeners may have noticed that the growing seasons are getting longer here. The USDA, or whoever it is that does the zone, garden zones, has changed their zone definitions in the past decade. Anybody, in fact, who is born since 1985 has never lived through a so-called average temperature for the globe. It's always been warmer than our long-term average since humans have been around. So many, many lines of evidence.
Polar ice caps are often brought up to show evidence of climate change, of what used to be often referred to as global warming. It's more referred to as climate change now. Mm-hmm. So are the polar ice caps smaller now than they were 20 years ago?
Yes. That's an easy question. Well, okay, so there are always some nuances, and in science thing, there are people always asking further questions and whys and hows and whatnot. So there are, you can measure the polar ice caps either by the area of the ice, how much space is covered by ice, or the thickness of the ice. And in the Arctic, certainly both of those things have gotten smaller. Of course, they fluctuate year to year a bit based on weather. The Antarctic is quite different because it's on land, and there are areas where the glaciers are moving off of the land into the oceans, and there are patches of the oceans where it looks like there actually is more extent of ice due to different weather patterns in that area. So you can't stand in one place and say, I'm standing here and I see the ice is growing, therefore climate change is not happening. You have to look at a big picture.
What would be the effect of less or very little ice in the polar caps?
Well,
beyond the scare tactics of what you might hear in the movies that come out of Hollywood, if there was very little ice, what would be the effect?
Well, some of the effects we know for sure. So when you melt ice that's on land, you cause sea level rise. So if you melt ice that's floating in the water, you don't do that. But melting ice in the Arctic region seems to be quite changing the weather in the area. So when you don't have the ice that reflects sunlight, you have water that absorbs sunlight, and so you actually increase the heating in the area. So that's why Alaska and northern Canada and northern Russia have had record high temperatures for their regions. That causes all kinds of problems, including melting of permafrost, and structures like houses and oil pipelines are actually supported on permafrost. And so that's an actual physical problem. You increase erosion around villages in Alaska. Some of them have been already having to move structures because without ice to protect the shoreline. And in fact, ice protects the shoreline for us here on Lake Superior in the winter from the storms.
Now, there's people out there right now listening, yelling at the radio right now, saying, well, the warmer temperatures have a lot of benefits too. And then they, you know, we'll say longer growing seasons, more food, more places people can live. What, when you hear these arguments, what is your response to them?
Well, it's true that warmer temperatures have some benefits in some places, and those people can keep yelling, but they should also listen. So, you know, people here might say, well, we don't really like winter. We'd rather have it be like Arkansas or someplace, and maybe that would be nice. People in Arkansas might say, well, you know, a week or 2 weeks per year of 100 degrees temperatures is enough. We don't want to have 6 months of 100 degree temperatures. So there are benefits and counter benefits in other places. If you want to.
Yeah, I would also say that we have the resources here in this country to be able to adapt maybe in ways that other places around the world wouldn't be able to adapt to these temperature changes. You know, Sarah or I mm-hmm. can run our air conditioners for a month more in the summer, and that's mildly annoying, but we can get on with our lives. But heat waves and more intense climate events in other parts of the country can, or in other parts of the world, can have devastating consequences for people that aren't as fortunate as us. So when you talk about climate influencing weather patterns to cause more droughts, to lead to widespread food shortages in other parts of the world, that's not so easy to adapt to. So we should think about this as a global change that's going to have some positive effects in some parts of the world, but lots of negative effects in other parts of the world.
Robert, I think you bring up a good point here, or at least for those who have the point of view of like where we live. If the Lake Superior region was to become slightly more tropical, there, you know, some people living here might see some benefit of that. We don't really see a lot of the negative, though, because one thing is we don't study the wildlife so much. You know, you folks do, you know, but people just living in their homes here don't see the changes, and we certainly don't see a lot of the devastating changes in other parts of the world. So what are those that we're not seeing when you're, you know, going through your day-to-day life here in the Lake Superior region, and it's, you know, you have some wacky winters or some summers, but you don't see a lot of big danger.
Well, people who fish might be concerned about the kinds of fish that like cold water. So we project that as streams get warmer, fish that spawn or live in cold water, like trout, might be less and less happy. The lake is warming up. Ice cover on small lakes ice covered season is getting shorter and shorter, so anyone who does ice fishing is concerned. With those changes in vegetation that you mentioned earlier, you also have potential changes in wildlife that depend on that vegetation. So when I walked my dog this morning, I flushed a grouse, and there's some ideas that, well, where are the grouse going to be as the vegetation changes? And these things are very difficult to predict because they're based on weather, on vegetation, on food availability, on potential for wildfires, on droughts, on extreme weather events. We recently had a huge rainstorm. Those kinds of heavy rains are projected to increase, so that increases costs on infrastructure, on road maintenance.
Yeah, I would also mention, you alluded to your tree example earlier about certain tree species moving north as the climate that is favorable to those tree species also moves north. There are some concerns that the temperature is changing more rapidly than those trees have the ability to move north. So the favorable habitat for a tree species is running away from that tree faster than that tree can catch up. So
trees don't walk very fast.
Yeah, it takes a while for trees to migrate north. So people who appreciate all of the recreational and hunting and just lifestyle opportunities of our great forests here may have some real long-term issues managing the forest that they love here. I'll just add a small plug. My twin brother works for the U.S. Forest Service station here in Houghton, and this is exactly the sort of issue that they work on, dealing with local land managers around the northern Great Lakes states, helping them to think about ways to change their forest plans to adapt to these known implications of climate change. They're going to have these tree migration issues, so they need to start thinking now about what changes they can make in their forest plans to ensure some sort of healthy forest 30, 50 years into the future.
I'd love to ask your brother about the insects, because talking with, I think it was a DNR wildlife expert who was saying that they're seeing a die-off in deer. Of course, there's a lot of factors that play into that, but also there's the disease-carrying insects are living longer during the year and are more prevalent because of the what they say is the warmer weather, and that our animal life actually is being reduced because they're being killed off more by disease-carrying insects. Love to ask your brother that one.
All sorts of these ecosystem impacts. Maybe we'll have to worry about Zika virus here in the UP in 20 years. Who knows? I mean, there's all sorts of things that are concerning.
And other things that might benefit us, although we might not always be happy about it. So if they have many, many more 100 degree temperatures further south, maybe we'll have a migration not only of trees but of humans up into our area.
Well, we
sure would have pluses and minuses.
With all the fresh water around here too, as well, and that would not necessarily be a great thing for those that like the a little bit of where we live. Now, Sarah, you had mentioned two words earlier on that I think are now the where the line in the sand is drawn, man-made. Okay, that climate change, man-made climate change, or man
human control.
Some who have gotten to the point they no longer can refute the scientific evidence that there is climate change, that there is a difference in the climate, and it's heading in one direction, not bouncing back and forth, is that they say, well, it's a natural cycle, or it's caused by the sun. That humans are, we have too small of an impact on the planet as a whole to be able to make a change like this. When you talk about those scientists, the 97% of scientists that agree about climate change is happening, they also agree that man and our ways of going about our daily lives is the cause of this.
And that's right. Yeah, the evidence is extremely strong that humans are causing this by increasing global greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And so, yes, climate has changed in the past, and we have more and more data about that, looking at the ice cores, looking at tree rings, looking at even diaries from ship captains and people, farmers. So we know that in recent past it's changed, and in the distant past it's changed, and in the far, far distant past the planet was unrecognizable to us. Forest fires are natural. Have natural causes too, but that's not to say that a human can't cause a forest fire. People die naturally, but that's not to say that some aren't murdered. So the fact that there have been natural changes doesn't mean that there can't be human changes that cause things. So we're understanding more and more about the causes of previous changes in the climate, and as we get down to understand those ice ages and recovery from ice ages, they always correspond to an increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And so those changes were natural, and they had to do with the orbit of the changes in the orbit of the Earth around the sun and other long-term changes. This change is happening much, much faster than anything we've seen from the historical record ever. It's hugely dramatic, but it also corresponds to an increase in greenhouse gases, and we can measure them. And we can measure that they are coming from fossil fuels, because there's a particular marker that fossil fuels, the carbon from fossil fuels is different from the carbon that was in the atmosphere before. We can measure that, and so we know, we can track where it's coming from.
Do you find it frustrating when you have you know, so much scientific evidence mounted mm-hmm. up, and mm-hmm. then somebody comes along and says, you know, yeah, but, you know, somebody fudged some numbers on one particular study from another, you know, from somewhere else, and that means mm-hmm. the whole mountain, mm-hmm. you know, they toss the whole mountain out. Mm-hmm. I've heard things, you know, like a single volcano eruption produces more carbon dioxide than all the vehicles mm-hmm. that ever been driven on the entire planet. And that gets rang out there, and then, mm-hmm. You know, it rings with some sense to the layperson. But you hear that, and mm-hmm. does it make you want to pull your hair out?
Yeah, sometimes. So there are people who are genuinely interested and want to understand the science, and they can call themselves skeptics or agnostics, as you did. And those are people who accumulate the evidence, look at the evidence, look at the data, and come to a conclusion based on the data. And then there are people who come to the conclusion first and then look for a piece of data that supports their conclusion and ignore all the rest.
Go ahead.
And those are the people who are swaying the argument or pushing an agenda, I would say.
Well, this is why I really like what you have set up here. You have a series of these climate science cafes and
free pizza.
Well, okay, that's definitely good. Besides eating a lot of good free pizza, what's going to happen at these cafes?
Well, I think our goal for each of these events, and they may vary from event to event, but basically we want to gather people. Someone like Sarah will kick things off by giving a short introductory,
very short,
10 minutes presentation to set the stage about a particular aspect of this huge issue. And then from there, we want to hear what everyone else has to say. And we might do different things to encourage people to ask questions or talk to their table mates about what they've heard and what issues they think might arise within this larger climate change issue. So we really just want to provoke different ways for people to discuss what they know, what they wish they knew more on, how they know what they think they know, and what their concerns are. So we want to get people talking about this larger issue and try and guide where we can that discussion if people have questions about the mechanics of how the science has been done or other mm-hmm. issues that Sarah can provide mm-hmm. some guidance on.
Now, due to some time constraints, by the time this episode airs, you will have had your first cafe. There's four of them. If you missed the first one, should you continue coming to one of the other three or all mm-hmm. of them?
Yes, absolutely. Come to any or all of them.
Okay, will they be different at all?
Yes.
The short answer is different.
Yeah, well, our presentation plan is different. We'll have different people at each one, and the discussion topics will be a little bit different, moving from the sort of basic science towards more how the energy system is aligned and how that contributes to climate change and how people can interact and engage in climate issues.
Now, in our short amount of time here, having only about 25 minutes to talk about mm-hmm. the issue, there's a lot of things that, you know, I could not possibly come up to ask all of the questions mm-hmm. that people may have, and I certainly am not able to give you folks enough time to explain all of the the scientific evidence, and we never even touched on, well, what can be done about it. So we'll save that for your seminars and or your cafes, mm-hmm. and I encourage people to come out and take part. It sounds like, you know, in the realm of that there's no stupid questions, right. It would be, you know, nothing would personify that better than these cafes. Ask those questions that you've heard. You know, some guy on the radio says, you know, blah, 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 and, you know, you don't know because you, of course, everything mm-hmm. we say on the radio is absolutely true, and just like on the internet, and you want to know because that's, you know, that is why you have something like this, to get those questions answered. You know, have a few less agnostics out there, maybe a few less skeptics. Not that being skeptical is bad, but this is mm-hmm. something that I think we would do a lot better as a human race if we could finally come to an agreement of where we stand on this and move forward and start thinking about solutions rather than constantly fighting over whether or not the Earth is round. Folks, I want to thank you so much for coming in. We'll post the dates and times of each of the seminar on KeweenawReport.com/community calendar. If people want to know more about climate change or about the seminars beyond that, how can they do that?
Well, they can email me for sure. I'm S. Green at Michigan Tech. And
we'll be posting Facebook updates, and we can share our contact information with you and make it available on the links that you post, and people can get in touch with any member of the community who's organizing these events, and we'd be happy to help.
Robert and Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And I'd also like to thank the Orpheum for allowing us to hold this event in their space.
Copper Country Today, we'll be right back.